I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Labor unions in Wisconsin were able to get enough names to organize a recall of Scott Walker, but they were not able to get enough votes last week to unseat the Republican governor. Walker took on the state's public employees and their collective bargaining rights shortly after being elected. In California last week, voters in San Diego and San Jose voted to cut back retirement benefits for municipal employees. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to focus on Pennsylvania's public labor unions, government workers, teachers, firefighters, police officers. What are their roles in today's workforce? And we have two guests who have joined us by telephone. Priyana Abraham is senior policy analyst at the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. And Priya, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Stephen Hertzenberg. He's executive director of the Keystone Research Center. And Steve, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Let me take last week's results in Wisconsin. And how do you interpret what the voters were saying, Steve?
I don't think it was as profound an election as some people think. I think there was a mix of things. One of the issues is that some of the people who didn't like Walker nonetheless felt that he should get a full four-year term, so they didn't vote for the recall. The second thing, which I think is obviously very important, is there was an overwhelming advantage financially in terms of money pouring in from outside the state to support Governor Walker. So you put those two things together, and I think this is a less critical election in terms of what it means about public sector workers than, let's say, the Ohio referendum some months back, where there was a direct question about whether or not public sector union rights should be reduced, and there was a strong majority of people in Ohio who said just plain no.
Well, Priya, do you think public sector workers then are under attack?
I don't know if they're under attack so much as people are beginning to look at the effect of very broad collective bargaining and how public sector unions work and the kind of impact that's having on government budgets across the country. And I do think Wisconsin is actually pretty significant in terms of, historically, when there are recall elections of governors, they tend to lose, whereas this was a vote of confidence in Governor Scott Walker. And at the same time, the budget reform issues that he put forth, the voters had enough time to see that they were working. He turned a $3.6 billion deficit into a surplus. And so they could see that these reforms that basically scaled back a bit about how public sector unions work was good for the economy. So I do think the election was significant in that regard.
Well, Steve, let me turn back to you. But do you think that public sector workers in Pennsylvania, do you think that they are going to be doing some soul searching? Or do you think in some ways that they are, if not under attack, certainly being looked at more closely, more carefully?
I think if unions in Pennsylvania, public and private sector, aren't doing some soul searching, given the trends of the last 20 or 30 years, that's a problem. So, this has been a challenging environment for unions for quite a long time. There are some tough tactical issues facing Pennsylvania's public sector unions. To some extent, they're insulated a little bit from attack because there were some pension reforms in Pennsylvania a couple of years back, which increased further workers' hefty contributions to their own pensions, which also reduced benefits in some modest ways in particular circumstances. I think compared to some other states where you don't have the kinds of generous contributions to public sector pensions by those workers themselves, Pennsylvania's workers are less vulnerable.
Priya, do you think it's time to rethink some of these public sector union contracts?
I do. I think the issue that we need to keep in mind is how public sector compensation really needs to be benchmarked to what people in the private sector earns. After all, the public sector, the government is funded entirely by taxpayer dollars, and the government is basically it's the will of the people, and it represents the people. you know, the yes, there have been pension reforms. I don't think they've gone far enough. And if anything, the sort of reforms that we've seen have basically pushed back the employer contribution, which is essentially the taxpayer contribution that we would need to see. And those are policies that the government unions have put forward. While you know, the contribution that Pennsylvania's government workers make towards their pensions, for example, is about 7.5% of salary, it is quite reasonable. They are, at the same time, they're not doing us any favors by advocating for the sort of policies that limit the amount that taxpayers contribute in the beginning, while having very generous benefits to begin with. So basically we have a situation where we've hit a pension crisis where taxpayer contributions are going to have to increase, our taxes are going to go up, and that has been pushed on to future generations. So, and these are not the sort of policies that end up benefiting Pennsylvania.
Let me turn back to you, Stephen. And certainly pensions is a huge issue, these unfunded liabilities in Pennsylvania and in other states as well. Do you see that as an issue that needs to be addressed, and people need to be able to sit around the table and if not renegotiate some of these contracts, at least take a hard look at them?
I think the state budget situation is challenging, and so that anything that costs money or costs more money in the near term, you know, is going to be part of the discussion. But I think it's important to correct a couple of of misperceptions. The first is you used the phrase, Marty, unfunded liability.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to the extent that this is unfunded, it's not because workers didn't contribute; it's because the state didn't contribute very unwisely in some years in the last decade when the stock market was doing very well. The state contributed Zippo. So it's the lack of employer responsible contributions that's the main reason now these liabilities are somewhat underfunded. I think the second thing, to go back to what Priya said before, is she wants to use the private sector as a benchmark for what public sectors make in compensation, that is, in wages plus benefits. In order to do that in Pennsylvania, you'd have to give public sector workers a raise, because when you take into account the education experience, the characteristics of public versus private sector workers, public sector workers make a lot less in wages. They do make more in benefits, but not enough to compensate for their disadvantage in wages. That's why you never hear someone say, I'm leaving the private sector to go make more money. People know that the real bucks is in the private sector, not the public sector. So, again, the idea that public sector workers are in some overall sense overpaid is simply wrong.
Well, let me pick up on that. And Priya, I went to the state government workforce statistics in preparation for the show, looking at government employees in Pennsylvania. The average length of service is 12 years. The average annual salary, $50,598. The average annual benefits, about $25,000 and some change. Let's say someone has a bachelor's or even maybe a master's degree. They've worked for 12 years. They're getting $50,000. Are they being overpaid?
It's not a question of overpaying or underpaying so much as it is, again, benchmarking to the private sector, which rewards according to performance and according to merit. So it's you know, a truly productive worker, one who's exceptional, really ought to get the bonuses and the compensation that they're earning. It's sort of this automatic assumption that a certain level of education or a certain number of years having served entitles you to a better compensation when it may not actually be tied to performance. That's the kind of benchmarking that we really need to see in the private sector. And you know, and I would say that for unionized workers, for example, tied to a certain pay schedule, that ends up hurting the workers who are really good, who are really exceptional, because you know, perhaps you are a teacher earning $65,000, but if you are exceptionally good, you really get through to your students, you're able to educate a lot of them to exceptional standards, then you might be worth $80,000 a year, but you know, that being tied to a union pay schedule prevents you from getting more compensation.
But does the private sector really reward good performance?
Yes, it does. It's that's the whole idea of you know, having merit pay and having bonuses and initiatives like that.
Well, Steve, let me turn back to you. And Priya is saying that under this unionized system, everyone is, in a sense, treated the same, looking at teachers, and teachers are not, good teachers are not rewarded for exemplary behavior. True, false? How do you respond to that?
I mean, first of all, the topic seems to be moving around a lot.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I think Priya didn't really challenge the conclusion from the data that public sector workers are not overpaid, given their experience and education. So it's important.
Well, hold on. Stephen, let me address that.
Yeah, you'll get a chance, Priya, I promise. Hold on 1 second.
Yeah, okay.
Stephen, go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Because, again, you could pay some workers more, some workers less. You could change the system of pay, but you're not, by doing that, going to change the average public sector versus private sector pay. I guess another thing I'll say is there's a lot of research on what kinds of pay systems are ultimately most productive. It's not clear that highly individualized pay systems, including in the educational setting, is always the way to go. One thing that does is tend to undermine cooperation among people. And in fact, in most work settings, certainly including education, it's mentoring, it's peer learning, it's the collaborative process through which teachers as a group get better at what they do that you really want to nurture. And I guess the last thing I'll say is, again, let's look back in time to a period in U.S. history when most workers' wages, at least non-supervisory workers, were either set by collective bargaining or at least heavily influenced by it. That is, the 1950s to the 1970s. What was the economic performance of the U.S. economy during that period of time? Oh, it was much better than since the 1970s. So the simplistic idea that we want individualized pay systems is wrong, and what that tends to lead to is certainly vastly greater inequality, and in many cases is counterproductive in terms of productivity.
And Priya, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that after this very short break. We are talking about public sector workers, focusing on Pennsylvania, but speaking more broadly than that as well. Stephen Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center. Also with us is Priya Abraham. She's Senior Policy Analyst at the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. We are going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Bosch Thermotechnology, manufacturer of geothermal heat pumps that use the constant temperature of the earth to heat and cool homes. More information at boschgeo.com.
Abington Health supports WHYY. Their Orthopedic and Spine Institute is performing a procedure called anterior hip replacement. Using a mini incision and specifically designed surgical table, surgeons at Abington and Lansdale Hospitals are able to replace the hip joint through the front rather than the side, sparing muscles. The hospital stay and the recovery time are shorter, enabling patients to return more quickly to regular activities, like driving. More at abingtonhealth.org/bone.
Join WHYY and Newsworks at the Michener Art Museum on Saturday, June 23rd for To Stir, Inform, and Inflame, The Art of Tony Auth. Enjoy a private lunch and lecture with Tony Auth and curator David Leopold, followed by a self-guided tour. Featuring 150 original drawings, the exhibition explores Auth's dynamic digital work. To register, visit whyy.org/events. The exhibit runs through October 21st. Visit MichenerArtMuseum.org.
Hey everybody, Jad here. Radiolab is coming to Philadelphia with a live show. We'll be joined on stage by Dimitri Martin, the musician Tao Nguyen, and the Palabolas Dance Theater. Come check us out at the Academy of Music on June 29th. Tickets are at radiolab.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're talking about public sector labor unions with our two guests, Priya Abraham and Stephen Hertzenberg. We have a full bank of calls here, but Priya, I know you wanted to say something in response to Stephen, who was responding to something that you said to in response to a question I was asking you about pay and benefits for government employees. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. I just, you know, very briefly just wanted to address the issue of overpaying and underpaying. When we have looked at Bureau of Labor Statistics about public sector compensation versus private sector compensation in within different areas in Pennsylvania, whether you're looking at Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or York, we have found just on salary alone public sector workers do tend to earn more than private sector workers. But I do want to emphasize that again, it's about making sure that compensation is benchmarked more to what the private sector does, and that workers are being rewarded according to merit and according to the job that they actually do, and not just basing it on a very kind of inflexible schedule or way of doing things.
But and I'm going back to these statistics, and again, they're broadly speaking. Obviously, 12 years of service, annual salary of almost $51,000, and it just seems to me let's you know take a government worker or a teacher or a firefighter or a police officer, that just doesn't seem like an exorbitant amount of money, even if they're a mediocre employee, that's a middle class, but not wildly middle class salary.
Sure. Well, Marty, I mean, it isn't just the salary. I think a lot of the reason that we have the crisis that we're seeing in so many municipalities and cities and states across the country it comes down to the benefits. The benefits mm-hmm. have been generally quite generous over when added to the salary, and that's the reason that we are seeing now that we're in a recession, in particular, that this has become unsustainable over the long run.
But how much responsibility does a legislature or even a governor play for or have in the level of benefits?
A lot of responsibility, actually. This is when it comes to pensions, for example. This is something where we said this is why the politics needs to be taken out of pensions. Because when you have a defined benefit plan, for example, which is what a lot of public workers have, where you pay into the system and then you're guaranteed a certain amount that you draw out every year right. in retirement, that tends to make the costs unpredictable, and it allows politicians essentially to promise benefits that the public cannot afford. And that's why the pension system as a whole really needs to be reformed.
Well, let me go back to you, Steve, and just picking up on this, something that you mentioned earlier about a decade ago in Pennsylvania, the pension systems actually had a surplus of cash. Those benefits were increased. And, of course, then we had the recession and the stock market implosion. And does that explain where this issue stands today?
Clearly, the fluctuations in the stock market and growth in the stock market not meeting earlier projections a part of the story. So is the lack of contributions by the state for portions of the last 10 years. So, again, as short-term situations change, does it mean there's going to be a need for some negotiation, just like there was a couple of years ago in the legislature? You know, maybe it does. But, I think there's a real tendency to demonize public sector workers, to fail to recognize that in the long term, this is a pretty small part of the overall budget picture. To the extent that it's a challenge right now, it's not really workers' fault. They were contributing all the time. And I guess the last thing I want to say is, let's think back to Priya's phrase of benchmarking to the private sector, and let's think about that in the context of pensions in particular. Benchmarking in the private sector with respect to pension means that at this point in history, more than half of workers get nothing. Most of the rest get a lousy 401k. A small number of high-level executives get great pensions, golden parachutes, things like that. In the public sector, by contrast, what you have is not a generous but a decent pension, so that the bus driver and the secretary and the food service worker, as well as the cabinet secretary, get a decent pension, a secure retirement based on their wages when they last worked and their years of service. Again, from my point of view, we should be talking about how do you benchmark private sector pensions to the public sector, even while we're dealing, as necessary, with some short and medium-term challenges around public sector pensions.
Well, let me go back to you, Steve. And as we know, Governor Corbett has been cutting the budget. There have been budget deficits that have to be addressed one way or the other. Can the legislature, can Pennsylvania afford to contribute more to these pension programs?
Well, again, the whole budget is a question of a lot of choices. If we're going to give Shell, the second biggest corporation in the world, $1.7 billion, I think is the figure, over some extended period of years to build a cracker plant in southwestern Pennsylvania that was probably going to be located there anyway, or if we're going to make other cuts in corporate taxes, or if we're not going to rectify a situation where a lot of corporations, even though we have a very high corporate net income tax on the books of nearly 10%, a lot of corporations, particularly bigger ones, don't pay an appropriate amount in corporate taxes because they play games in terms of bookkeeping games. So some of our financial problems are revenue problems, not because we're spending too much. So, yes, there are some tough choices, but you can't put the majority of our budget challenges at the foot of public sector workers.
Priya, let me go back to you. And actually, Bob Brady, a Democratic congressman, had a piece in today's Inquirer talking about a woman who was working as a security officer at a hospital, making $10 an hour. It's private security, and that's what she was being paid, and is considering joining a union in order to get better benefits and obviously to get better pay as well. And I think there's a concern that when you use the private sector as a model, it becomes a race to the bottom. What's your response?
Well, I don't know if that Stephen can really have it both ways, where the private sector is both the envy and then, but then is something that we don't want to emulate. It's like America has been doing great and prospering with workers putting money into their retirement and having that nest egg when they retire. And basically, I mean, the public sector is supported by the private sector. That's why this benchmarking is so important.
What do you mean by that? The public sector?
Because the public sector, the government is supported by taxpayers.
Right. But this notion that when you, and this is speaking broadly, obviously, but when you look at the private sector, and that there is a concern that what you end up is paying people less than a living wage, and yes, you save money, but do you save money in the long run?
Well, I mean, Marty, I would just say, well, look at the situation that our budgets are in now. If these benefits were so sustainable, if we could actually pay workers what we are promising them in 10, 15, 30 years from now, why are we in such a budget crisis now?
Stephen?
I mean, the biggest reason we're in a budget crisis now is because we had a very deep recession. So tax revenues across the board are down a lot over the last several years.
Right, here's another problem with the way we do pensions is that we assume a rate of return that's really over the, if you take a decent number of years, isn't really going to work. That is partly the problem with our unfunded liabilities in Pennsylvania, is that we're assuming that the stock market is going to return more than it is, and then we increase and promise benefits to workers that we can't really deliver, and that's not fair to them.
Certainly, we put out a report with the Center for American Progress in, I think, 2007, where we talked about the need for what's called normal costing contributions to pensions every year. That is, what it means is you've got to put in enough money to cover the cost of new obligations that year, no matter what's happened with the stock market, right? And the point of that is to get away. The temptation of politicians, Priya's right on this, is that when the stock market is doing well, they say, oh, good, we don't have to spend that money over here. We don't have to raise taxes, and let's take that money we were going to contribute to pensions and use it for something else. And so those short-term pressures are a problem, and that's why we were among the first to recommend a reform that unfortunately wasn't put in place back when we recommended it.
In a sense, what they did was kick the can down the road.
Yeah, to some extent. And then a couple years ago, they did a combination of kicking the can further down the road, as Priya implied earlier, a little bit. But they did do, they made some reforms, such as even higher contributions from workers and some cuts in benefits. And I apologize for the construction outside my office. I'm going to go back on mute every time I stop.
Okay, fair enough. And this is live radio, and that's Stephen Hertzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, joining us along with Priya Abraham. She's a senior policy analyst at the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. We're talking about public sector labor unions, and as we know, certainly an issue in Wisconsin and in California and other states as well. We want to focus in on Pennsylvania and take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to Tom from Bluebell to join us. And Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to make the point that in this comparison between the public and the private sector, regardless of how many years experience and what their education level is, you got to admit that the average public service worker is not as productive as a private worker.
What makes you say that, Tom? What's your evidence for that?
Have you ever walked into City Hall when you needed a copy of something, or walked into the DMV, or is there any public service where you feel like you're overwhelmed by the service and that the people are really trying to help you to the best of their ability?
Well, Steve, let me toss this to you, because this certainly is a perception out there. True, not true?
Not true. I mean, there's a wide variation in public sector workers, just as there is in private. But many public sector workers, I was one for the U.S. Department of Labor and the U.S. Congress for about a decade, and many of the people I worked with worked 60, 65 hours a week. They're very mission-driven. The same thing is true of people I happen to know in Pennsylvania, in the Department of Labor and Industry, in the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, partly because people don't work in professional jobs in the public sector for the money. That is, they make less than they could make on the outside. They're still there because they care about the public service mission. So are there some people who don't pull their weight? Absolutely. That's really a management challenge, and so there's a mix.
What do you think, Priya?
Well, I would agree that there is a mix, but that's even if public sector workers aren't a big monolith, why are we essentially treating them the same way with having a very rigid pay schedule? We should be having a more individualized compensation and rewarding people according to their productivity.
Whoops, I don't know. We've got all sorts of noises going on in the background there. Don't answer that phone, whoever you are. Let me give Cynthia from Norristown a chance to weigh in. And Cynthia, that would be number three. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
I am a retired public school teacher in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, I also help train new teachers to join the profession. And my comment is, how do we attract those highly qualified, talented, dedicated individuals to join the profession of teaching if we're not going to compensate them in a fashion that's going to help them pay off that high student debt that they are accumulating in order to join the profession? We are part of a long process to train students to become productive individuals. How do we attract those talented people if we're not going to compensate them? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
You're welcome, Cynthia. Thanks for the call. Priya, let me toss that to you.
It's a no. I don't think anyone is saying we should underpay teachers. People know how valuable teachers are. They train up our next generation who will guarantee the future prosperity of our country. So, you know, attracting the right teachers and, you know, making sure our education system is functioning, is something's got to change in the way we do things. The current system that we have just isn't working. It's essentially a monopoly that we have in education. It doesn't allow the professional freedom and variation that we need to adapt to a highly competitive and highly changing global economy. We need to be able to offer teachers compensation as well as the professional freedom to adapt and innovate as we need in this kind of economy.
Are you opposed to collective bargaining?
Am I opposed to collective bargaining?
Yes.
I think that the effect of collective bargaining over the years has been that it's become too strong, and probably it needs to be limited in a lot of cases.
Steve, go ahead.
I think the caller is right that there is a challenge with attracting high quality teachers. If you look at the U.S. compared to, let's say, some other countries that tend to do much better than us on international tests of how of student achievement, like Japan, I mean, relative pay of teachers tends to be higher in those other places. So, and I think another nuanced implication of what the caller's asking is that if in fact you manage to reduce pensions for teachers, precisely because that would make the recruitment and retention of teachers tougher, quality teachers tougher, unless you change wages, you'd actually have to increase wages to counteract the impact of the cut in pensions. So again, the bottom line is that when it comes to the so-called pension reforms and move to so-called defined contribution plans that PREA's organization and others support, it wouldn't actually save us any money. And I guess one last thing I'll say is that, I mean, in terms of how you get to good education, the international evidence doesn't say it's got anything to do with, quote, choice and competition. The international evidence doesn't suggest that unions are a problem when it comes to high achievement. The keys to high achievement are adequate and equitable investment in education for all kids, no matter the community, investment in early childhood education, and stronger systems of teacher training, mentoring, and peer support than exist in much of the U.S. We don't have great systems to make every teacher as good as they can be. So we were working on all of those problems in Pennsylvania until the huge cuts in public education in the last budget and with more with no increases in funding expected in the current budget. That's a problem.
Well, and we have to take another short break and then get back to our conversation. Stephen Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center. Also with us is Priya Abraham. I'm sure, Priya, you want to say something after this short break. Senior Policy Analyst at the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. And we invited both of them to join us to get two different perspectives on public sector labor unions. It's being discussed in states across the country, including here in Pennsylvania. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Cayley Group. Presenting Irish Traditional Music, Influences from the West of Ireland, Saturday evening, June 16th at 8. The concert features singer Niamh Parsons and guitarist Graham Dunn. Niamh will also conduct a workshop in the singing of Irish songs, and Graham will present a workshop on guitar. Both workshops and concert take place at the Commodore Barry Club in West Mount Airy. Tickets at philadelphiacayleygroup.org.
Men and intimacy. No, it's not an oxymoron. In the name of masculinity, there's emphasis on independence and competition, which many experts say can have a negative impact on mental and physical health and relationships. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, the importance of emotional intimacy in men's lives. today at noon here on WHYY FM.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports WHYY. Penn's Master of Liberal Arts allows students to tailor their program to suit their interests in the humanities and the natural and social sciences. Instructors and peers share perspectives that can help students hone their thinking, synthesize information from multiple disciplines, and communicate their ideas. Part-time options and evening classes are designed to fit the needs of working professionals. Details on how to pursue your passion at Penn by searching Penn MLA.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Priya Abraham and Stephen Hertzenberg and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are kind of all over the place as we're talking about public sector unions in this hour of Radio Times. But Priya, going back to you, and I know having read some of the things that you have written, you talk about teacher accountability, about merit pay, that would create a system that you think of that would reward, in the case of teachers, reward good teachers?
And I can give you the example of Jamie Escalante out in Los Angeles back in the 1980s. Jamie was a phenomenal calculus teacher and was really able to educate and reach his students and have them perform exceptionally well. And he could get up to 50 kids in his classroom and still do well with them. Unfortunately, the union limitation in the contract was 35 students. So that ended up basically cramping his style. And we need to be allowing that kind of innovation to flourish. And that's the current system we have in place between thinking inside the box that only public education of funding and funding cuts is going to spell doom and gloom is the wrong way to go. We are in a situation now where we have fewer resources to go around and taxpayers are exhausted. We have a way to provide education, and that is through school choice, allowing a bunch of different educational opportunities to flourish and putting educational decisions back in the hands of families. And we can still do what we need to do. We can do more with less, but we need to allow these sort of options to flourish.
Go ahead, Steve, and then we'll get back to our callers. School
again,
choice.
Yeah, again, there's no compelling evidence that school choice, whether it's vouchers in the U.S., or, again, the evidence from looking at different countries that school choice is the answer. I mean, I said it in my last answer, sort of what we take away from the international evidence. Some of that is that it's not like our systems should stay exactly the same. And so I talked explicitly about...
But that's what unions do.
No, that's,
they keep the system exactly the same.
Hold on, Priya. Go ahead, Steve.
No, they don't. There's a whole community of union locals across the United States. Pittsburgh is one great example where you see collaboration to improve systems of, again, teacher induction and mentoring, teacher supervision, systems of so-called peer review. So, I mean, Priya's clearly right that we don't want horribly inflexible educational systems. We need to see what works and keep experimenting and use data and evidence to sort of guide what happens each and every year as we continuously improve. All of those things are not a union or no union issue. So to some extent, I think her attack on sort of this cartoonish figure of an intransigent union is something of a red herring.
Go ahead, Priya, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Well, if we are taking the example of Pittsburgh, and I think this has been the pattern across the country as well, where we have had school choice options, and this is why having different options of things like charter schools and cyber schools and other options like that working, is that they produce a sort of competition in the education world that improves standards across the board, even within school districts. And Stephen talked about there not being any evidence of vouchers working. That's simply not true. We're going on about 20 years of evidence, and we of the nine or ten gold standard studies that we have, the academic outcomes for voucher students improved for all of some. There's not been a single negative impact on them.
Well, Priya, just a quick response here, because Philadelphia has been doing about a 10-year experiment on education for K through 12, and there is school choice. There are charters, and while some are good, some are not good, and it turns out that the public schools have done, in terms of competition, have done okay against these charters.
And it's partly because you're injecting competition into the situation. And then I think that's what happened with Pittsburgh. The administrators freely admit it's like, were it not for the fact that students were now choosing to go to charter schools, that there were now these different options, we would have not had to look hard at how we do things and basically improve the quality of education that we offer.
A quick response, Steve, then we will get back to our callers. Anything you want to add to that?
Marty talked about the Philadelphia experience. It's the Stanford University study of charter schools that sort of came down with the conclusion that, by and large, charter schools were doing less well, even though there was some variation, than public schools with equivalent students. So, again, I think that's the bottom line, is that the overall results from choice are mediocre or worse. Where you get benefits from vouchers or from charter schools, it's because of peer effects. It's because you concentrate, you either put low-income kids in a school where most kids aren't low-income, or you put groups of students with the most motivated parents into a school. Oh, what a surprise that the school does better. It's not about the educational systems being overwhelmingly superior to the public school systems, although there's ample room for innovation improvement. And again, the core system of teacher training and support is not what it should be in the highly decentralized U.S. educational system. That's where we should be focusing.
Well, we're talking about the role of public unions, and of course that takes us into many different corners of discussion. Let me get, looks like Ted from Langhorne to join us on Radio Times. And Ted, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm a pensioner. I was a teacher for 32 years in the public schools. I track the pensions, I track the contributions, I read their balance sheets. I've called several times complaining about the way they invest the money, how they manage the money. Their answer to me is, we can do whatever we want to.
And who's the they that you're talking about, Ted?
State pension persons that manage the funds. I don't know in particular. I don't recall the names right now.
Right.
But they seem to have free will. They do it whatever they want. When you look at their balance sheets, you can see how they're losing our money.
Well, let me.
I kept complaining about that, and
okay.
They did nothing.
Okay, fair enough.
Keep
fair
on
enough.
Losing it.
Okay, it's a good point. And let me give. It sounds like you want to say something, Steve, and I'm sure you do as well, Priya.
Well, yeah, and I don't think this is one where necessarily Priya and I are going to disagree. But I mean, there are folks that oversee the teachers' pensions, and then pensions for other public sector employees. There is a board. That includes some legislators, and I think also includes some of the representatives from public sector unions. So there is oversight. I mean, there's debate about whether or not at times the investment of money has been too conservative, too risky. So I guess what I would say is there are systems of accountability to state government and to employees, and so I'm not sure that's really the core thrust of this conversation. But
fair enough. Priya, I'm thinking about the track record of the private sector, the Wall Street implosion of a couple of years ago. It seems that they have a lot of work to do as well. Priya?
Right. One thing I would say just about when it comes to contract negotiations. A lot of this discussion has centered on, what is the role of public sector unions? What should we think about collective bargaining and so on? And what we have found across the country, certainly this is what people in San Jose and San Diego just found, and is that there is something about the whole process that tends to allow for certain interest groups to take hold of both our budget and the political process. In a union contract negotiation, you have a political leader who doesn't necessarily have the public's interests at heart. He may be thinking more likely of his own political career. You have a union leader who has a vested interest in making sure that he gets the best possible benefits in a contract, whether or not those are sustainable or not. Those are closed-door negotiations that don't necessarily include the taxpayer, and that's a missing element here.
Would you agree with that, Steve? You don't have to.
Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, I think the biggest problem, we're sort of getting into the weeds here, but yeah. I mean, but I think the biggest danger in terms of the management of public sector pension funds might be the financial interests of Wall Street and the political influence. So what you've got is situations where financial services firms use political contributions and political influence to get a larger role in managing funds and therefore to earn greater fees, and that opens the door sometimes to risky investments like derivatives, and I'm an economist and I don't really know what they are, and so that's the that's the biggest challenge. So you do need care in terms of not allowing public sector pension funds to be invested in a way that exposes them to too much of the kind of Wall Street risk you talked about.
Let me get looks like David from Maple Glen to join our conversation. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say that there's a misapprehension. I think it's deliberate on the part of conservatives, and it's from ignorance on the part of many liberals about unions and whether they are it's unions versus paying teachers according to merit. Unions don't inherently prevent even public employees from being paid according to merit. If you look at the universities in this state that are unionized, they pay some faculty $200,000. But what they do is they set a base pay, and then if someone needs to get more money in order to come to that job, they can pay as much as they want. It's the same with in the private sector with Newspaper Guild, for example. They set a base wage for reporters, but you get a good columnist or a good investigative reporter, the university, the newspaper pays them whatever it takes to get them. So there's no inherent reason why public teachers or other public employees can't be paid for being better than everybody else.
Well, it's an interesting point, David. Let me see what Priya Abraham says. Priya?
Well, I mean, the flip side of the issue is having employees who are not necessarily good or who may even actually be bad employees being compensated more highly than they deserve or being protected when they really ought to be fired. And that's that is another negative effect of having just the union protections that basically are protecting the wrong workers.
Do you agree with that, Steve? That part of what unions end up doing is protecting and making sure that the underperforming or the bad employee keeps their job.
Well, first thing I want to do is underscore what a good point the caller made. There's a lot of unions in Hollywood that operate the same way in terms of sort of providing a baseline, making sure that, you know, people who are becoming actors at the same time as waiting tables aren't exploited too much. And so there's a lot more flexibility to how you set pay and bargain over pay and advancement. And so therefore it's not the impediment that Paria's suggesting to innovation and designing the best possible system that gets you, in the context of education, greater educational achievement. The unions, it was Al Fondi, the president of the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers, who once said it very succinctly: unions do not exist to protect their weakest members. They don't. So what you need, and again, peer review is an example in place in lots of unionized school districts across the country. You need fair and transparent supervision and evaluation systems. And as long as you've got that, and unions and union members are convinced that people are losing their job ultimately, not because they speak up too much or they're a union activist, but because, in fact, they're not a good enough teacher to be in the classroom, then they're okay with that. So, again, it's a management challenge, and it's one that more school districts across the country are stepping up to. It's also fundamentally, unions come in lots of different shapes and sizes, and one of our challenges now is that manufacturing unions defending people against being unfairly fired, grievance procedures, that was a big part of what manufacturing unions do. So we're still getting over the transition to unionism in a sort of knowledge-based economy, and unions and certainly managements sometimes are struggling with that transition. But again, the good news is there's lots of places that demonstrate you can adapt unions and pay systems and evaluation systems in ways that will work in a knowledge-based economy going forward, and so we should be working on that. Not trying to deny workers their right to form a union.
And Priya, well, final word to you. We have about 20 seconds. I apologize for that.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I just want to say this is not about denying workers their right to form a union. If they want to be in a union, they should. If they don't, they don't. And that's what we saw in Wisconsin. When they had the option of being in the union, they opted not to do that. In AFSCME, their membership fell from about 63,000 to 28,000 by more than half. So workers themselves are voting with their feet.
Well, on that note, we could keep going. My thanks to both of you. I realize we covered a lot of territory in this hour. Priya Abraham, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Stephen Hertzberg, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. We welcome Michaela Cross, who joins us along with Jared Brausch, our interns for the summer, and Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.